Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian podcast from the magazine that is beseeching you to email us your Ask a Libertarian Webathon question right now to roundtable@reason.com for a bonus taping we are doing Wednesday, and this is Monday. Email it now. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nicholas B., Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu. Ward, happy post-giving, everyone.
2.2, Matt. 2.2. That's the number of pounds I gained.
Webathon howdy to you, yeah. My fat friends.
Happy Cyber Monday.
I'm going to focus on
could have said I
the
was
accuracy
a kilogram.
Of Nick Gillespie's scale
I gained
right now.
A kilogram. That sounds better. We should go to the metric system until I reduce.
Didn't realize you were going to end on the verb. All right. So let's get to the main event. And I don't mean in this case the rumble in the jungle, nor the flood the tree lighting protest at Rockefeller Center this Wednesday being organized by anti-Israel demonstrators after their brilliant successes in gluing themselves to the Macy's parade route and then shutting down the Manhattan Bridge yesterday as I was about ready to drive over the damn thing. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the insanity in the Hannity on Thursday in Georgia between, thank you, Nick, between Florida governor and distant second place GOP presidential contestant Ron DeSantis, and California Governor Gavin Newsom, who wants to be president so bad it's almost messing up his Pat Riley style haircut. Moderator Sean Hannity is billing the showdown as being not just a would-be presidential debate, but rather a referendum on the California model of governance versus the Florida model of red versus blue, said the Fox News host in a quote to Politico that definitely wasn't written out beforehand. I'm into mixed martial arts, and anybody that steps into the octagon, I have deep respect for, because you're stepping into a war. This is one of those moments where you have two heavyweights in the political arena that are going to have an opportunity to go head to head and talk about substantive real issues and governing philosophies that affect everyone's lives. I want to hear the tape recording of that. I think that we should take the football tossing KCSB alumnus at his word and use the opportunity to make a libertarian bite down on the body politic with the kind of setup that public policy on the state and local level sometimes is a little bit sharper in distinction than what we get in national politics. So, Catherine, you just did a whole damn issue on Florida Man and Florida Politics Man. What relatable human facts did you learn about the governance in the Sunshine State?
So yeah, the Florida issue for subscribers should have hit your inboxes last week and will be hitting your mailboxes soon. And you can't do a Florida issue without talking about DeSantis. And one thing that we did in the issue is kind of rehash the Disney kerfuffle, which is ongoing. Disney is still kind of engaged in this battle with DeSantis. And I really think the Disney battle is DeSantis. Like, it actually is who he is as a person and who he would be as a president, which is just like he will choose the culture war over sensible governance. And it's not to say that he hasn't done a bunch of sensible things in Florida. He has. And, you know, if we're going to compare the California model to the Florida model, Florida all day, every day. But a lot of the stuff that's good about Florida is either in spite of DeSantis or existed before DeSantis. And the Disney fight is the future of politics. And it's stupid and it's ugly and it doesn't even really make a lot of sense. Like, it's not that real. Like, Disney did a squishy little LGBT statement and everyone lost their minds. That's not how we should be conducting our politics or setting our priorities, but it will be in the future.
But Catherine, didn't I read on Twitter this weekend, so therefore it's true, that Disney came out with like a statement to shareholders saying, yeah, maybe this whole ESG thing wasn't all that swell. Didn't DeSantis win, in other words?
He might have won one of the battles. the war continues to be stupid. But also, yes, he's right that ESG as a governing corporate philosophy has gone off the rails in all kinds of ways. He is wrong that the solution is for the governor of the state in which your company that is doing ESG happens to exist can solve that problem. This is not a problem for governors to solve. It is only a problem for governors and presidents to make worse.
And ESG stands for electro-sodium glutamate, if I'm not mistaken.
It makes everything more delicious and just.
Nick, in 1990, California had basically the same population as Florida and Texas combined, around 30 million. Since then, Florida has grown in population by about 70%. California at 30%, which is lower than the overall population growth of these here United States. What should we glean from these numbers, Nick?
Well, first off, I want to say that I'm really looking forward to this debate, and it's something that, you know, had been talked about a while ago. It is the debate that America needs, if not necessarily the television that America wants. I talked to Jeb Bush, former governor, former Republican presidential candidate or nominee, whatever, would be presidential nominee.
Failure.
For the recent Florida issue, which is great. And everybody should not just read, but should get a digital subscription right now, supplement it with a print subscription, and also send in a letter or a question, Matt, to subscriptions or whatever it is at Reason.com.
Roundtable at Reason.com.
For all of this. But this is, you know, Florida versus California is the question in front of us. And you can also throw in New York versus Texas on the undercard. What you are seeing are the two behemoth states. California and New York were, you know, defined America in the 20th century. New York for the first half, California for the second. They have been losing people because they are too costly. People are moving en masse because it is too costly to live there, to create jobs there, and to reside there. And they are going to Texas and Florida. That doesn't mean everything Texas and Florida does is good, but they are offering a radically different or a radically simple alternative, which is that they tax lower, they regulate lower, and they offer lower services. Not necessarily worse services. One of the most interesting things that Jeb Bush talked about was how, in terms of higher education, when you look at Florida State and University of Florida, as well as a bunch of newer regional kind of directional state universities, University of Central Florida, Southern Florida, have emerged over the past couple decades. They are super cheap and they are incredibly good higher education establishments in a way that California in particular, it's really hard to get into the UC system. Now, even Cal State's colleges, which were safety schools for decades, are oversubscribed. California is failing to deliver the services that its people are paying for, so they're leaving. This is going to be great, I think. I want to hear about it if I may also just say, though, when I said they're alternatives and they're pretty simple or stunning, they're not absolute. Somebody like Ron DeSantis, and this is another thing that Jeb Bush talked about, his national profile is different than his in-state profile, where he works across the aisle to pass certain things, including certain kinds of bans on offshore drilling, et cetera, that he doesn't talk about when he talks nationally. So the difference between California and Florida is not the difference between the Soviet Union and the United States. It is more like the difference between, maybe Scandinavia and the United States. And it gets complicated very quickly.
It's funny to think about, the gap between the national personality and the local personality. Gavin Newsom, with his neediness so obvious that he wants to be the replacement presidential candidate from the Democratic Party, has been acting in ways that are a hell of a lot more centrist on various things like crime and disorder and homelessness and such.
And when you look at his evolution from being mayor of San Francisco, where he was sending out directives saying, cut bagels in quarters because city employees are getting too fat, like at any brunch that the city had, and declaring that homeless people can grow crops on road medians anywhere there's grass. You know, where he was going kind of full Pol Pot or Colonel Kurtz, he's pulled back a little bit from that. So, you know, maybe that's not a bad thing.
Peter, you're from Florida. We have kind of, I think, sort of tiptoed over or went quickly through how DeSantis policy-wise on the state level has been preferable to Gavin Newsom policy-wise on his state level. Can you expand on that a little bit? What you've criticized DeSantis a lot on this podcast, a lot on this podcast, Peter Suderman, and that's fine because we're libertarians and we hate politicians. However, has he done anything right? What's he done good?
Well, I think what he's done mainly that is good is that he hasn't messed with Florida's winning combination of economic policies, which is no state income tax, generally cheaper housing, and just all around lower cost of living, right? And so that's why Florida has always, or for at least for a long time, been a place where retirees go, because retirees are in many cases on fixed incomes. And if you don't have a lot of money, it's not a terrible place to live because stuff is cheap and they don't tax you too much. And also it's warm and you're near the beach and there's crazy people around and that's kind of funny.
You know, if I may, one of the interesting things about Florida, and this is true of a bunch of former Confederate states, interestingly, that go after retirees, it isn't like a flat and fair tax. They subsidize retirees. You don't pay school taxes. You get a cut on certain kinds of property taxes and things like that are pretty significant. So again, you know, this is not, they are stark alternatives to one another, but it is not the difference between socialism and laissez-faire anarcho-capitalism. It's something more, you know, it's a little bit murkier than that.
The other thing that DeSantis got right, broadly speaking, was COVID policy, especially in comparison to big blue states like New York and California. And that's why you see that while there has always been, you know, sort of a movement towards Florida for retirees, there is an acceleration of movement out of California specifically to Florida specifically, starting in 2020 and then really accelerating out of the last couple of years. And so that even though the numbers are relatively small, actually in terms of California's total population of about 39 million, there's only like something like 200,000 people that, you know, the state has only dropped in population by about 200,000 people. There aren't that many who have actually moved to Florida, but there has been a spike in the rate, right? It has been it's a lot more, and it seems like it is increasing because Florida is just offering value for living. And so that means you can get a job, and it means your taxes are going to be low, and it means that it's going to be warm and you can afford a house. And this is the other thing, is that relative to California, Florida has kept housing prices low, and California's housing costs are just absolutely insanely high, and people who are not really quite well off cannot afford to own a house or rent there.
If I may, Catherine, there is also, I've been thinking a lot about this, and I've lived in red states and I've lived in blue states, and I've chosen to live in two massively blue cities, DC and now New York. And one of the things that is different than 20 years ago, I wrote a piece that I got a lot of shit for, because when I was living in Huntsville, Texas, a prison town where you could buy a 5-bedroom house for $80,000 and there were no takers, I started thinking a lot about the demand for living rather than the cost of living, which is what we typically talk about. And there just isn't much of a demand for living in Huntsville, Texas, despite low, low prices and immense safety, right? You know, because like every fucking cop in Texas is like, you know, within an arm's reach of Huntsville. And, you know, part of it, what was different back then is that living in Huntsville was living like living in an open air prison. There wasn't that much to do, and you couldn't access things. What has happened over the past two decades is that places like Florida and places like Texas, they're a lot more like places like Los Angeles or New York. All of the amenities of larger cities are more easily available. Florida and Texas both have many cities that are growing in size and kind of cultural accoutrement and things like that. And so that demand for living has changed in a substantial way. Places like New York City, and Matt, I would love to hear you support living in New York City despite the premium that you pay or that we pay. But, you know, cities, it's easier to approximate the richer cultural life as well as the more kind of tolerant and wide-ranging population demographics that you get in big cities, in smaller towns, in suburbs, and things like that. And that gives a real advantage to places like Texas and Florida And if California and New York don't respond, if they don't adjust, they're going to become, you know, even more kind of lumbering wrecks than they already are.
I think that I'm not going to be defending living in New York City for very much longer at the current rate.
But don't move upstate. Upstate is everything bad about New York without the hustle and bustle.
No. I would if I moved to another American city, I would move to Miami, Florida, and it wouldn't even be close. It would be immediate, but it's kind of a big hassle, and not going to do it. No, my feeling about New York is I'm so aware of the cost, psychic cost, and material cost on a minute by minute basis that I am trying to squeeze as much life out of the life, take advantage of what New York has to offer that even Miami cannot match. Do that within the significant parameters of my own, stamina and appetites for such things. But you have to take advantage of it, or why are you here? Is my feeling. Catherine, enough about that. I got three words for you: high speed rail. Please clap, and if you can, given that the Reason Foundation hero Bob Poole lives in Florida, has the world's greatest model train. I'm always fearful of how I describe this, because if I get it wrong, he gets mad. But anyways, there's high-speed rail in Florida. There isn't in California. What's the difference? How'd that happen?
So I first want to say that I actually was in New York this weekend for Thanksgiving and went to see the model trains at the Bronx Botanical Gardens, which are very, very nice.
Oh, nice.
And so New York also can at least boast model trains for itself. but the Brightline train in Florida, which Reason has a great video about if you want to go watch it and learn, is a really cool model of how you might actually build some high-speed rail in a way that makes sense and makes money. California, meanwhile, has just like... It remains almost unbelievable to me. Like, it is hard for me to believe how badly they have screwed up high-speed rail. They just, like, throw darts at the map of California for where the trains might start and end, like, seemingly without regard to places that people might want to go. And then also fail to build those lines. When they do build a little bit, it is just a shocking price per mile. Reason has done a ton of work on this, but the contrast with the, you know, with the Brightline train is, you know, it is so simple and so straightforward. It is just, is this ongoing tranches of government money for some theoretical future, maybe useful train, or is it people trying to make their own money in the form of profits by building something that people want? And that's it. That's it. That's like the simplest version of it. It's like, why is it a million bazillion dollars to go to the doctor and you don't know how much it's going to be? And then actually maybe you never receive any healthcare versus when you go to the dentist and they just give you a bill. Brightline is the dentist of high speed rail. And I mean that as a compliment.
The veterinarian?
I wouldn't know from veterinarians, but dentists I know.
Peter, about 20 years ago, I think, there was a book that got a ton of attention by, I'm going to get all their names wrong, but Rui Teixeira and John Judas, mm-hmm. close enough for government work, called The Coming
think
Democratic.
Mark Teixeira. Actually, he pronounces it different. He pronounces it more Spanish.
But.
What was the book called again? I think you got three words out of it.
Coming Democratic Majority, or the Emerging Democratic Majority. And a lot of that was
the
based
not
on
not happening Democratic Majority.
Was based on kind of the demographics that when you increase immigration, as was happening, especially in the 90s and a little bit afterwards, that those new voters tend to vote Democratic. That's overly simplified. They have a new version of the book coming out now, sort of a reflection on it that talks about what they got right and wrong, which I'm sure is pretty interesting. Just inviting you to maybe use that as a frame to reflect on the fact that Florida has gone from being just the swing state. It was the swing state in 2000, obviously, but again and again, and then sort of tilted Republican. And now under DeSantis, it has become really reliably Republican at a time when it continues to just pile in immigrants from all over the Caribbean. California, meanwhile, has gone super Democratic after being kind of a swing state back in 1990. Do you, like I, celebrate the fact that people are individuals? Damn it. What do you think about that, that differentiation in sort of political response by the immigrants in the two places?
So one thing that's notable about California versus Florida is that migrants to Florida, whether they are from out of the country or inside the country, tend to be lower education and lower income. And that tells you a lot about the state of the red-blue divide in America right now, because the Republican Party is becoming even more the party of the less educated and lower income people. And that means a lot of immigrants. That means a lot of older people. And that is part of the appeal of Donald Trump in this era, is that he has captured a kind of lower income, lower education base. And the lower income, lower education base has a lot of minorities in it, a lot of folks who aren't, you know, your kind of classic stereotypical bad Republican villain types, right? The rich white men who benefit from upper income taxes. And it is a real shift in the parties that has happened over the last couple of decades, in part because Donald Trump courted it, in part because Democrats have done an incredibly terrible job of managing to keep their coalition together. And you just see that in every single poll that comes out about Joe Biden in particular, where he's losing black voters, he's losing Hispanic voters, he's losing young voters, particularly voters under 30. And it looks like it is at least possible, based on the polls today, far from certain because we're, you know, nearly a year out from the election, but at least possible that next year voters under 30 will actually vote more for Trump than for Biden. And even if that doesn't happen, it's quite likely that they won't prove this sort of big bulwark, this mass that just powers Biden into the White House again, as younger voters who are now, of course, getting closer to middle age did during the Obama era.
All right. Lightning round from the first segment here. Which is to say, I've already expressed my desire or preference to live in Florida rather than California. Where would you guys, if you had to choose, gun to the head, and you can't do a Krav Maga maneuver to get out of the gun of the situation, which state would you move? And one sentence of why, starting with Catherine.
Florida is the ancestral homeland for me. My parents are Floridians. They went to the University of Florida. But if I am being fully honest with myself, despite my love of and origins in Florida, I'm going to move to the Bay Area if I'm moving somewhere. And I'm sorry, but it's true. It's who I am as a person. It's where the people I like to hang out with are. I know it's also where, like, the fentanyl addicts are or whatever. But, like, that's the truth. I'm a coastal elitist.
No.
Gillespie?
Yeah, I'm going to Los Angeles because so Catherine is doubly wrong because she's going to the wrong state, as both of us are. But then you're going to the wrong area, the wrong region in the wrong state. I'm going to L.A. because that's where my family is. That's where reason is headquartered. And I'll take a stand, while promoting. I love the fact that people are moving to different parts of the country and they're moving to new states that are going to dominate the cultural imagination of America. But people also need to recognize that economic determinism isn't everything. In fact, it is, you want jobs, that's important. Beyond that, it's a lot of other factors, and things like the tax rate are lower down than I think many libertarians, particularly many libertarians who live in DC or New York or high tax places, reside. So, Los Angeles.
Suderman.
Unfortunately, I'm going to have to go with California because I lived in Florida once and never again. And also because it's prettier. And really the biggest reason is because the industries that are in California, there are companies that I might be interested in working for, aside from Reason, which of course has a base there, though I would of course love to, continue working for Reason.
Right? In and Out Burger?
Right? Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Burgers.
Double animal style. Right? And that really is California's strength in so many ways. And one of the reasons it has gotten away with such consistently terrible policy is because there are a bunch of big industries and really high profile employers that it can use in some ways as tax cattle. And it can just it says, well, look, we've got Apple here and we've got Hollywood here, and therefore we can have terrible policy that is extractive from those industries and use it to support all of our other dumb ideas.
My Miami preference is based on youth, dynamism, and Cubans. And I think that's enough. All right. Today is the fourth of a four-day hostage release ceasefire or pause of warfare in the Israel-Hamas war. As of Monday morning, when we're taping this, the terrorist government of the Gaza Strip had released 58 of the estimated 240 people they kidnapped in Israel during the October 7th massacre. This includes a four-year-old American girl. Israel has released 117 Palestinian prisoners from its jails, and the international community has trucked in a bunch of humanitarian aid to the Strip. The truce, which was brokered by the Hamas-supporting government of Qatar, as well as the Israel-supporting government of the United States, is likely to be extended by at least 2 days, according to the Egyptian government as of Monday morning. Israel has been seeking at least 10 hostage releases per day. There are reportedly 40 to 50 being held in Gaza, not under the jurisdiction of Hamas, but by other organizations such as Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Israel's war aims ever since October 7th have been to bring all the hostages back and also to destroy Hamas in Gaza while preventing any replacement government from being able to wage similar types of warfare. And that's kind of where we are right now. Not a lot to sort of argue about necessarily, but I wanted to mark the news and just get kind of a basic reaction as we see these kind of moving scenes of families reunited. Nick, looking at all this, what strikes your interest or imagination?
I'm extremely happy to see hostages being released and that being a condition of a ceasefire and things like that. It makes total sense to me. And it might move towards some kind of resolution that isn't, you know, that doesn't end in total war and more chaos and misery for all considered. I want to point people to a piece at Responsible Statecraft. We'll drop it in the show notes by John Mueller. He's an emeritus professor of political science at Ohio State, a Reason contributor, Cato adjunct scholar and whatnot, formerly the Woody Hayes chair in political science at Ohio State, which is kind of the greatest title of all. But he talked about in this piece about how the U.S. responded stupidly or unthinkingly to 9/11 and ended up not achieving the goals that it sought as expeditiously as it might have if it did at all. And he counsels that Israel probably would have been better served by, brokering something very quickly and then going after on a very kind of, subaltern way, going after the Hamas leadership and things like that. And, I think that that's a plausible alternative to what we're seeing. But whenever hostages are released on terms acceptable to both sides, that's good. That's the starting point of a good resolution, which I think has to, ultimately end with Hamas being dispossessed of power in Gaza.
Catherine, as a parent, what's it like? Are you just shielding your eyes from it? Is it too much to watch these kind of family reunions? What's your reaction to this stuff?
I'm struck by how the family reunions are yet another Rorschach test for the internet. There's a lot of video out there of especially kids being reunited with their parents. And there are people who are watching these videos and saying, look, you can see that these children were well treated. They are healthy and fine. And there are also people watching the exact same video and saying, look at the darkness and despair in that child's eyes. They will never be okay again. And so it reminds me of, did we talk about this on this podcast recently? The Terri Schiavo era, when everyone on the entire country briefly became a neurologist when a woman who was sort of tragically in a vegetative state got caught in a conflict over her parents, between her parents and her husband, about whether she should be unplugged. And everyone saw what they wanted to see in the videos based on their priors. And so I think there's just so much of that going on that I actually find the discourse more painful than the videos themselves. I've said on this podcast before, the one thing in the news that becoming a parent changed for me was anything where a tiny baby gets taken from its mother, I lose my shit now. So like any of these stories where like there's a, you know, you eat a poppy bagel and then you get drug tested at the hospital and they take away your newborn. Absolutely not. Like that just like is now a visceral reaction, whereas before it was just a principled one. And so that is triggered by these Hamas kidnappings. And I would like to approach it rationally and not emotionally, but that's hard.
Separation policy at the border was not your favorite policy?
Exactly. I mean, just like I very, very hard for me to take a deep breath and think rationally about it because how dare? How dare?
But I mean, there is like there's not an equivalence between Israel does not go into Gaza and kidnap children or kill them explicitly for, you know, with no other point. Right. Yeah. I mean,
claiming equivalence.
Yeah, but I'm saying when you're saying like, oh, well, it's a Rorschach test for people, like if your response to Hamas giving back a bunch of infant hostages or you know, two-year-old children that it seized a month ago, if your and I'm not saying your response, I'm saying people who's like, oh, well, you know, that shows that everything is going to be fine. It's like, no, I mean, I find the discussion about, you know, that what happened on October 7th, like bizarre, because it's like Hamas is a governing authority and it has been acting like a terrorist state so that, you know, you can't be like, oh, well, you know, it's like this is just governments fighting amongst themselves. It's like it isn't. It's not equivalent.
I agree, Peter, with what you just said, but I don't see how it connects to what I just said. And I just want to make that distinction clear.
I'm saying what you're
expressing frustration at the thing that you were noticing.
Yeah, you're saying like it's a Rorschach test. You know, the difference is that in a Rorschach test, there's no wrong answer. I think
Nick?
No, really. There is something morally wrong if you walk away from a reunification video and be like, oh, okay, now things are fine. This worked out.
That's great.
Peter, what's your reaction besides deepening your affection for Nick and Catherine?
Like Nick, I am obviously happy to see hostages being released. But the other thing that's notable to me is that there are talks about extending the pause in fighting if Hamas is willing to release 10 more hostages per day, is what I've seen. And the problem seems to be that Hamas doesn't maybe know where a lot of the hostages are, in part because they are not all being held by Hamas. Instead, they are being held by smaller, more radical groups like the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and maybe even just by private citizens who are not clearly affiliated with a group that has a name. And that tells us, I think, a lot about the state of the war and just how messy the finishing process is. Because, okay, sure, maybe you can kind of defeat Hamas, but what even is that if it doesn't have control over all of these hostages that were taken on October 7th? And also, it tells us about what a mess it's going to be after the war is finished, which hopefully will be soon, right? I mean, you just don't want this to extend forever. And you don't want to see this sort of murder and this sort of killing and destruction kind of continue, right? And governance of an area like that, where even the kind of putative governing authority doesn't know what's going on and doesn't have any control, is going to be quite difficult because of the fragmentation and because of the inherent weakness of being governed by a terrorist organization like Hamas.
I'm morbidly interested in the spate of reporting from Israel about how and this is going to sound grotesque because it is how Hamas basically was the dog that caught the car. They didn't expect to be so quote unquote successful in doing all the murder rampage kidnapping. And now like, oh, wow, huh, that was a lot. So we didn't really like think through what the impact will be. What the impact is, you are going to be removed by violent force. And there's going to be dead babies as a result, which is horrible, including Justin Amash's second cousin, which is just horrifying to contemplate. But
in addition to being barbaric, they are also a bunch of idiots.
Weird how that goes hand in hand. All right, let's get to our listener email of the week here in a second. But first, a second or perhaps third reminder that our annual webathon starts tomorrow. We have a week-long event in which we ask you, dear listeners, to contribute to the nonprofit in a tax-deductible way to finance our activities here. As part of our commitment to customer service in that, we will be taping a bonus episode of the Roundtable that does nothing but respond to your emails. It may be some jazz hands as well. So for that, not for the jazz hands, but for the emails, send them to us at roundtable@reason.com. This week's query on the normal podcast here comes from Larkin, who writes, "Dear Roundtablers, with the victory of Javier Milei in Argentina, it would be interesting to hear your thoughts on the responsibility of libertarians, or even so-called libertarians, upon gaining power, especially in terms of the economy. For example, I agree with many of the anarchist policies that Catherine espouses, but would President KMW go full scorched earth right from the start? Is there not a balance needed between implementing the full system changes required in the long run with minimizing harm in the short term? Or more simply, should Milei rush ahead with his economic agenda? Or does he risk causing such catastrophe in the short term that, one, he may not be able to stay in the job to see out his agenda to fruition, or two, he will damage the libertarian brand and make it harder for people with similar policies to get elected? Thanks. Enjoy the show. Larkin, Catherine, you were named. What say you?"
I am not a burn it all down gal. I am a controlled burn gal. And I, you know, in kind of 2023 American politics, I am an incrementalist, both out of necessity, because ain't nobody really got time for what I want to do, but also because I think that that is the right way to do change. So for Milei, obviously, the concern is like, how long is that guy going to be in office? And I, if I had to say, would guess like not super long. He also, I think, still doesn't really have a full governing coalition. So it's not clear that he has the option to burn it all down from his current position. However, I think, you know, instant implementation of anarchic or libertarian policies would definitely set everyone back decades. So I don't want that. I would focus on things that are hard to undo. Right. So just issuing a bunch of executive orders in the American context, for example, just means you will create confusion and uncertainty and rage in most cases. Instead, I think working to dismantle bureaucracies, which that's why you see photos of Milei and he's always got like a chainsaw or like a sword or like some sort of something with a cutting edge. You know, that's, I think that's kind of the right approach. So sort of dismantling bureaucracies, consolidating agencies, deregulation. In the U.S. context, this would also mean doing what you can on entitlements. In the Argentine context, I think that the central question is dollarization. I do recommend to you Bryn Hobart's email, which has a great, juicy, how could dollarization go thing. And this footnote that I want to share. Disclosure, says Bryn, "I own an Argentinian equity ETF, albeit temporarily. This is not based on deep research into the country's long-term prospects, but on a more prosaic observation. Libertarians really like expressing their affinity for winners on their side, but compared to other groups, have disproportionately high purchasing power and a propensity to express opinions by buying financial assets." So he is betting on American and other libertarians betting on Argentina in the short run to make money in the short run. That's telling both the betting and the short run.
Nick, thoughts on the letter?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And we have models for kind of what Milei is talking about in the breakup of the Soviet Union. And Milei has already talked about taking the nationally owned money-losing airline for Argentina, the state-owned Argentina airline, and offering it first to employees to see if they want to buy it and try and turn it around and run it profitably as a company. So, you know, he's signaled that he's not going to do stuff by presidential decree. He's trying to work with, you know, the legislature, which is a real he is going to have to be an incredibly good diplomat and politician to put together a kind of functioning majority that will get any of this done. I think he's, you know, I think his message going in was right. And it seems like all of the steps or all of the things he's talking about doing now are right. And that means a kind of legally incremental change. More power to him.
Peter, thoughts?
To govern well, you need a clear view of the of your ideal end state. And you also need a practical and sustainable path to getting there or as close as you can. And the balance of ambition and practicality, or frankly, even compromise, is just tough to get right, even for the smartest people. But that is politics. And even more than that, it is leadership. Bringing together, and I'm gonna use the word here that Catherine hates and that in some ways also makes me go every time I hear it, but you have to bring together the relevant stakeholders. Boo. You actually do, right? And you have to get buy-in so that you can do stuff that you want to do. And that is probably something that ardent libertarians, or a certain strain of ardent libertarian who is maybe not always a fan of political leadership of any kind, could probably stand to think about a little bit more. What makes just someone just a good leader, period, somewhat independent of their policy views? And it's one of the reasons why I'm skeptical of someone like Donald Trump, who I do not think was a very good leader and very good at getting buy-in from all the relevant parties.
So the example of post-communist governance is pretty interesting to watch, and there's, I think, it's continues to be an unresolved debate over shock therapy and which reforms you do first, and what do you sell off in terms of the government ownership of private firms, whatnot, what do you do with pensions, all of that, and the speed of it. One thing, and I don't have the firm answer on any of those things. My views continue to change. One of the bounds that you have is not just in terms of presidential authority, what you can do and what you can't do. In the American context, you know, a president can do a whole lot of things with foreign policy, with immigration, some reversal of recent executive orders and regulations, not a ton. And you also have the pardon power, which is can be pretty powerful. Different countries have different ideas about that. But fast action of any kind can prove to bring a boomerang effect. So choosing the right ones that are most important and in the right order is an art, and no one really has the right answers. I watched in Czechoslovakia in 1990 when a unity government with huge popularity and a kind of a shining figure of Václav Havel made a bunch of decisions in short succession that really pissed off a lot of people. Some of them were economic and they were fast. They were going to do coupon privatization of state-owned firms, but also he emptied the jails. So all the criminals came out, as well as the political prisoners. It was pretty broad. He shut down the entire defense industry, which was pretty crushing to Slovakia, which was part of the country back then, and issued an apology for the expulsion of the Sudeten Germans after World War II, which got a lot of people in the former Lebensraum area to be a little bit mad. So that kind of soured the political project pretty quickly out of the gate. So choosing your battles wisely, but also recognizing that the clock is ticking on what you can do economically is going to be tough. I see that he's already dismantled, I think, the Ministry for Gender Diversity and Inclusion or something like that. That sounds fine. if he has the power to dismantle a bunch of dumb bureaucracies, that sounds like a great use of his time. Looks like dollarization is going to be the most difficult haul. So I would imagine that he's going to be focusing as much as he can on that.
There's a thing you can do where you just work backwards from the most recent dumb thing. Like that's the, you know, dismantling the gender bureaucracy stuff. One reason that that's going to succeed is because it's only been around for 5 minutes and nobody's like political identity is necessarily built on that. It doesn't necessarily get you the top priority thing done right away. And I do feel like we've all been very cautious here in this segment. And I do want to say, like, he should do what he can do. Like, he should go hard. It's just a question of, like, you know, what. Where are the limits of that? I do recommend to anyone who's interested in this our piece by Jarrett Decker, Lost in Transition, which was on the anniversary of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And he really takes apart like how vulgar Keynesianism, right, the idea that you just like privatize stuff and then the market sorted out, can go wrong. And the answer in the case of the Soviet Union, or his answer, is if in the end people don't have faith that those property rights will be respected, like, Coase can't do his magic. You can't get that magic. And I think that that would be something people in Argentina would have reason to fear. And so I think anything you can do to shore up the belief that in privatizing state assets, that people will then hold those assets, you know, as true private property and be able to use them in a market context, like, that's the most valuable thing.
I think there's also, you know, he is facing the Peronist problem, you know, in the Peronist party, most recently Cristina Kirchner, who was jailed and was corrupt beyond belief, but whose party still holds a significant, you know, amount of power. The question in Argentina, in a lot of ways, and this makes the job harder, is building a coalition that finally moves past Peronism, which has been a horrible, you know, burden on the country, along with the right-wing military dictatorship that Milei, and to me, this is the most troubling aspect of his personage. He is constantly undercutting the amount of political murder that was committed by a right-wing junta. But if we're going with Catherine's, you know, kind of recency proposal, the Kirchner, you know, under Cristina Kirchner is when everything went off the rails in the past decade, and kind of pushing against that and keeping always in mind the idea that what we're trying to get to is a general level prosperity that is not based, you know, that is not undercut all the time by massive inflation and official lying. You know, I think he might be able to pull it off.
All right. Lightning round time. On Sunday, Massachusetts Senator and secret Peter Suderman girlfriend, Elizabeth Warren, celebrated the temporary consumer ceasefire between Black Friday and Cyber Monday by tweeting the following words: "We don't need another private equity deal that could lead to higher food prices for consumers. The FTC is right to investigate whether the purchase of Subway by the same firm that owns Jimmy John's and McAllister's Deli creates a sandwich shop monopoly." Catherine, can you pretty please use this as a teaching moment? Not for Elizabeth Warren, because she's too fucking stupid, but for other people who might think that this is a good thing for the government to be inquiring into.
Elizabeth Warren is not stupid. She is wrong. And that's an important distinction.
I disagree.
But I saw a response to that tweet that said, "She's the hero we need." And I cannot for the life of myself tell if that was a sandwich pun or not, but I love it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Not all heroes wear capes.
Yeah. The very notion of
you're really going to make Swiss cheese out of this
monopoly
proposal
is laughable. There are many vectors for sandwich acquisition, including making your own sandwich, including yelling at your wife to make me a sandwich. There are so many ways to get sandwiches that have nothing to do with these couple of companies. Such a great Baptist and bootleggers opportunity here, right? There are people who, like, sincerely, deeply believe that the bigness of Big Sandwich is a threat to the Republic. And there's, like, I don't know, Potbelly or something who's, you know, paying Elizabeth Warren to say this stuff to bust up and generally impose costs on their competitors. We are not at risk from Big Sandwich. In fact, it's just in general, any tweet that says the FTC was right to investigate, like, stop there. No.
Peter, I noticed that Derwinder Schnitzel wasn't part of this.
Hmm. That's because hot dogs are not sandwiches, Matt.
See, that's what I'm saying. Mm. Like, is she, like, coming down and, like, making a definitive judgment from her senatorial perch?
This is the lightning round, so I'm just going to read you the top response to Warren's tweet. It's from an account named Mostly Peaceful Memes. It's at Mostly Peaceful, and it just says, "Thank you, Senator. For too long, Big Sandwich has been holding back working Americans from experiencing the riches of Bidenomics." That's my response to "I'm with Mostly."
Are you secretly that account? Tell us now. Mostly yeah, Peaceful Memes.
Not.
The Suderman.
I deny.
Faux account.
Nick, what's... what should we learn from
this moment? I'm looking at a tweet which will drop in the show notes as well, because, you know, at least five people read the show notes. But it's of one of those mini combines where it's a KFC, a Pizza Hut, and a Taco Bell all in the same place. This is the new axis of evil, right? we got real problems. This should demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt that Elizabeth Warren, I was going to call her Elizabeth Moron, is so obsessed with interposing herself between every goddamn transaction in America. She should quit being a senator and just be like a freelance Budinsky who makes sure that everybody gets exact change after every transaction.
I'm not clear on what the distinction is.
It is of a piece with her demand a while ago that all consumer electronics have the same plug, because she doesn't want to have to buy two, you know, a plug for an Apple product and one for a Google or Android product or whatever. This is insanity, and she's welcome to it, but she really should not be in charge of dictating government policy about economic matters. This shows a complete inability to understand how markets operate and how markets operate to the benefit of the poorest among us.
I would just use this as an opportunity to slime the media with whatever sauce of your choice. Just in that, during the 2016, I forget.
It doesn't even matter. It's just in the past.
In the past, when she ran for president, she was clearly the choice of national political journalists. I mean, it was just horrifyingly obvious. And their argument is, oh, she's a wonk. You know, she's just like me. She's a wonk. She really gets it. She's smart. And, you know, we need more people like that.
Does the subway triangle, do the cheese triangles overlap in the proper pattern, Matt, to get the ultimate coverage when you melt a subway sub?
Americans, you know,
we need somebody in Washington on our side.
Of perfect cheese allocation.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go to our end of show. What we have been consuming besides foot-long Italian-style bread sandwiches. Nick, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, so last Monday I went to see Bob Dylan, Nobel laureate Bob Dylan, on his Rough and Rowdy Ways tour in Newark, New Jersey, at the NJPAC. And it was a fantastic concert. There's a set list. It is Bob Dylan is, you know, Matt, you know the Double Nickels on the Dime album by the Minutemen, and there's a song in that where at one point D. Boone says, you know, he's talking about punk music, and he says, this is Bob Dylan to me. And Bob Dylan is Bob Dylan to me. And it is amazing to see an 82-year-old guy who has been performing longer than I've been alive, and I am fucking 60 years old. It is tremendous. He is kind of live mixing the last 100 years of popular music and popular culture in America. You need to be a kind of adept, I think, to understand what he's doing, because it's really hard, even if you know all of his songs, to understand what song he's playing at a given point, because he shuffles it around. He did Gotta Serve Somebody from the Great Slow Train Coming album, which you wouldn't have recognized if you didn't know the lyrics, and things like that. But it was a great moment to see somebody who has been so important to the last 60 plus years of American popular culture, really at the top of his game at the age of 82. And then in New Jersey, he gave shout outs to people like Queen Latifah and Frankie Valli and Old Blue Eyes. So it's highly recommend seeing Dylan. You know, he's been on a never ending tour for decades now. But that will come to an end, and probably sooner rather than later. But I highly recommend the Rough and Rowdy Ways tour.
Did he play Tweeter and the Monkey Man?
He did not. I was disappointed going in, because he's been doing site-specific covers. He covered a Leonard Cohen song in Montreal, for instance. And I was really hoping that he would do it a Springsteen song, and that it would be Tweeter and the Monkey Man.
Too bad. Peter, what did you consider?
I saw Napoleon, the new biopic from Ridley Scott, who, like Bob Dylan, is in his 80s. He is 85 freaking years old, and he is still making movies at a really high level. He's got, this is like a $150, $200 million epic. He's got two more movies in the works already, including a follow-up to Gladiator. There was a great profile of him in The New Yorker recently, the worst part of which was the person who said, who told the reporter that Ridley Scott, because of his advanced age, is the single best argument for Joe Biden's second term. No. No. But Napoleon is also interesting, and maybe Napoleon may in its own way be an argument against Joe Biden's second term as well as Donald Trump's. It stars Joaquin Phoenix as, of course, the French military leader of the title who became
Joaquin?
Emperor.
Joaquin?
Yeah, isn't that his name, right?
Joaquin.
Okay.
So Phoenix, Joaquin? Joaquin?
Joaquin.
Whatever.
Joaquin.
Stars that guy.
He used to be called Leaf,
stars
by the way.
Joker. Stars the Joker as the French military leader who became emperor, waged a lot of war in Europe a couple hundred years ago. And the movie is exquisite, just absolutely gorgeous to look at in every single frame. It's also quite sardonically and darkly funny in its own way. And it's also kind of a mess narratively. There is reportedly a 4-hour and 15-minute version of this movie coming. Oh. The theatrical cut is about 2:35, which means there's almost, you know, there's close to 2 hours of additional movie out there to kind of make it all make sense. So it feels a little bit episodic, but it is fascinating in its own way, because it is a kind of anti-biopic in that it is a takedown of its central character, right? This isn't just an anti-war film. It is an anti-politics film that is built around the idea that political and nationalist ambition are awful. And it portrays Napoleon not as a great man or a conquering hero. He wasn't noble. In this portrayal, he was a pathetic little shit who was deeply insecure, and his ambitions were driven by his insecurities. And those ambitions ended up in the end killing 3 million people. And so it is a movie about the stupidity and patheticness and shallowness of political ambition, and also how even stupid pathetic political ambition can be incredibly barbaric and murderous.
If you want a more accurate look at Napoleon, I recommend...
Wait, one where he doesn't cannonball the pyramids?
There's a like a 5-6-part French miniseries that came out 10, 15 years ago starring Christian Clavier, a great comedic actor, in it. And it's fantastic. So I seek it out.
The any anti-war, anti-Napoleon movie coming out of a Brit is always suspect
it,
from the get-go.
It is, in fact, very
and it's
clear.
It's like when Ridley Scott gets around to critiquing the English Empire, the British Empire, it'll be time to listen, right?
It is, in fact, very clear that Ridley Scott is British and like kind of hates French people. Also,
and Napoleon is short and ignoble because he's a Corsican, et cetera, with a tiny penis, who's a cuck, right?
Yeah. And he likes Pollocks. Catherine, what did you consume?
I want to apologize in advance for what I'm about to recommend, but also sincerely recommend it to the subset of people to whom it appeals. I recommend to you a mini series of podcasts within a larger podcast. The larger podcast is called Dungeons and Daddies. It is not a BDSM podcast, I wanted to say right now. It was recommended to me by the man that makes this podcast sound good, Ian Kaiser. Shout out to Ian. But specifically, he knew that 46 episodes of D&D podcast is too much for me. But there is a 3-episode arc totally separate from the rest of the podcast called Sons and Sons Ability. It is a Dungeons and Dragons podcast set in Regency England, inspired by the works of Jane Austen. And it's so good. If those words appeal to you, you will love this. I know that the vast majority of people are like, what in the nonsense is she saying? But some of you, I know, are like, ooh.
Since you asked me whether I was mostly peaceful memes, I got to ask, did you make this podcast?
I did it. And the only reason you know I didn't is because the governing conceit of Dungeons and Daddies is it's dads who have, like, regular suburban dads who have been dropped into the Dungeons and Dragons fantasy world and have to go on a quest. So it's dad based. And I am not, in fact, a dad. It's delightful. And so I recommend to you Sons and Sons Ability, the Dungeons and Daddies special side quest podcast. I said what I said. So there.
I would recommend a movie, animated movie that I saw for the first time with my 8-year-old from
Steamboat
1999.
Steamboat Willie?
Called, and we've already seen that one, called Iron Giant. It's the debut picture by Brad Bird, who did the Incredibles movies and others besides. And it's about a big iron giant who comes down from the sky and is discovered by a precocious little 10-year-old kid in like Maine or New Hampshire or some damn place. And then there's a kid with a single mom whose voice is played by Jennifer Aniston. And the kid tries to like hide it. And there's like rapacious Cold War like generals and military guys on the take.
Beatniks.
There's a beatnik named Dean.
Yeah.
Nick Gillespie. Mm-hmm. Played by Harry Connick Jr.
Isn't the Iron Giant played by Vin Diesel at Vin his Diesel. Gruntiest?
I will just once again say there is no bit of cultural detritus that isn't accessible in Nick Gillespie's Bob Dylan aged brain. It's an amazing talent. Emmett Walsh is also in there.
Yeah, he's fantastic at everything. It's also based on a book by Ted Hughes, the former poet laureate of England and husband to everybody's favorite dead poet, Sylvia Plath.
I mean,
it's a great fantastic. Movie. I'd say I saw Peter nodding along. It's really a fantastically sweet, beautiful kids movie that's great for adults.
Yeah, and it's got like some winning kind of anti-military industrial complex hippie stuff. There's art and the animation's very nice. So 8-year-old thumbs up, 55-year-old thumbs up, and apparently Gillespie Suderman dual thumbs up, which is pretty rare in the cinematic universe.
When The Incredibles came out, there was a big debate about whether Brad Bird was maybe a libertarian or a Randian because of the idea in the movie that, well, you know, when everybody's special, no one is, and that, you know, these kids were actually, the kids in the movie were actually quite special because they had superpowers, and there's this idea of, and in fact, individual difference matters. And of course, you know, there was some like distancing on the part of like Disney and Pixar and, you know, whoever it was.
And Bird himself.
Himself from those ideas, from the Randianness of those ideas. But if you watch The Iron Giant, it's just so clear that he is steeped in, if not like the deepest Randian Atlas Shrugged, like just like that's all that's on his brain kind of mindset. He is so clearly steeped in all of these ideas that what makes people interesting and good is individual difference, is art, is creativity, is separating yourself from a world that expects you to go and fight their stupid wars. And in fact, what you want to do in life is like make something that is beautiful and be friends with other people. It's an incredibly libertarian movie and set of ideas that he's working from. And you see that in his later works, maybe to a lesser extent as well.
Like Ratatouille.
I want to just very quickly, well, he came in partway through Ratatouille, but Syndrome, Buddy Pine is the hero of The Incredibles. And he is a Randian hero, not because he is born a certain way, but because he creates the world that he wants to live in.
I was not expecting these left turns and right turns besides, but that's why this is a delightful podcast for you to be listening to. The Reasoned Roundtable podcast. And thank you for listening to it. We're going to give you a bonus episode. Don't know when it's going to come out, but we're recording it on Wednesday. We're going to be taking your questions. So send them to us. Roundtable at Reasoned.
That is Jen's Day, I believe, in Peter's new pronunciation of J sounds. Right.
That's...
And go back to, as long as we're talking about detritus, Matt Welch, Joaquin Phoenix used to appear as Leaf Phoenix. And I think he made his debut in the great Cold War thriller Ruskies, where a Soviet Navy guy, seaman, washes up on the shore of Florida, and a bunch of kids have to hide him out. While
surely it's
out
pronounced
what to do with
Ruskies?
Ruskies.
Ruskies. Okay, so here's what you do. Send those emails, like I said. Get ready for the webathon.
That's begins to tomorrow. Roundtable at Reason.
Roundtable at Reason.com. Thank you, Nick. I haven't said it enough. Nick, are there any events in New York City that you would like to advertise at this little spot in the podcast?
Yes, I would. On December 12th, we're interviewing Jennifer Burns, author of a phenomenal and yet not perfect biography of Milton Friedman. It's called The Last Conservative, which is part of the bone that I will pick with her. But that's on December 12th in New York City. Go to reason.com/events to get a ticket and get more information. That'll also be a future video and Reason interview podcast. And go to Reason's newsletters page, reason.com/newsletter. Sign up for all our newsletters, including our NYC events newsletter, where you'll get special invitations to everything we're doing.
Nice. All right. Thank you for listening. We'll catch you next Monday. Goodbye.